This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Matthew Alexander, was a senior military interrogator in Iraq. In 2006, he led an interrogation team that tracked down Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. Alexander is known for rejecting and criticizing harsh interrogation techniques, such as sleep deprivation, stress positions, and waterboarding. He says his team was able to track down Zarqawi by building trust and rapport with members of Zarqawi's network held in a prison in northern Iraq. Alexander chronicled that experience in his book, How to Break a Terrorist. His new book describes his experience as part of a special forces team that conducted dozens of raids at homes of suspected al-Qaeda members. His role was primarily to interrogate suspected insurgents and their families in their homes on those raids. Matthew Alexander is an 18-year veteran of the Air Force and Air Force Reserves. A four-time combat veteran of Bosnia, Kosovo, and Iraq, he was awarded a Bronze Star for his service in Iraq. His new book is called Kill or Capture. Well, Matthew Alexander, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you worked for a period of time at a prison where you were stationary and detainees were brought in and you would do interrogations. And then for a period of time, you were the lead interrogator where you would supervise others. Did you have sort of a standard way to begin an interrogation?
There were several ways that I would begin. Sometimes I would walk in with a copy, my copy of the Quran, and I would recite a line. Usually I would use the first line of the Quran, which is "Praise be to Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful," which would help me to show compassion towards my enemy who's sitting in front of me, but then also put in place an obligation of reciprocity on their part to show compassion towards me by reciprocating, by providing information. Sometimes I just started with questions. What's your name? Where are you from? Tell me a little bit about your life. Because the first step of any interrogation is to understand your detainee. Understand what uniquely motivates them as an individual. Why did they join al-Qaeda or another insurgent group? Why did they decide to pick up arms? And if you can analyze them and figure out those motivations, then you can craft an appropriate approach and incentive, but not until you've done that.
I noticed that you would often begin by saying, I'm going to treat you with respect, and I would like you to treat me with respect. By which I mean, you don't lie to me. And it seems in a lot of the prisoner interrogations that you reconstruct for us in these books that the detainees quickly lie. Almost all of them seem to lie initially, or at least you believe they lie. Do you then confront them?
Sometimes you do, but sometimes you let them get away with the lie. For instance, I don't really care if anybody ever admits to participating in terrorist activity. I could have somebody on tape, you know, having prepared suicide bombers to go out on missions. We had detainees who we had on tape having cut people's heads off with machetes. But I would let them lie about that all day, as long as they were telling the truth about the information I needed to go out and kill or capture the next target. That's the difference between, you know, law enforcement interrogation, you know, I was a criminal investigator, and intelligence interrogation. And some interrogators, even in the military, forgot this, that they're not there to get a confession. In fact, I believe that the confession hurts you because it reminds both them and the interrogator that you're opponents. So I would gladly allow them to lie about their participation in terrorist activity as long as they're telling me the truth about the information I needed.
A couple of the techniques that you mentioned in the book, one of them is called the pride and ego up. Explain what that is.
Well, pride and ego up is an approach where you try to elevate the pride of the detainee. You stroke their ego. And then you use that in a spirit to say that they have power. They have what they call in Arabic wasta, which is power and influence. And with that power and influence, they can affect their own fate. They can change their destiny by cooperating with you. Or maybe you can put them in a position of power, like I offered one senior al-Qaeda member a chance to be in a position in the future of Iraq and to play a role in the future of Iraq. By which he sold out Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda.
And were you, in fact, in any position to offer him a role in the leadership of Iraq?
Well, to me, the role that he did play was to find and kill Zarqawi, which was a role in the future of Iraq, a very important one. Unfortunately, when I was in Iraq, and I think this is still true to this day, interrogators and senior interrogators don't have the power to offer real incentives and to make them good. So, for instance, I can't walk in and offer a guy $100,000 to provide me the location of a senior al-Qaeda member. I can't walk in and say, I'll get your family members' visas out of the country so that you don't face reprisals for giving us this information. And that's a real change. You know, in Vietnam, we had real incentives that interrogators could offer captured Viet Cong members to get them to turn to our side. But we didn't do that in Iraq. And it wasn't until General Petraeus got there and offered the Sunni tribes money and weapons that they turned against al-Qaeda with the offering of a real incentive.
But it seems that there were often times in which you would appear to offer them things or offer things that you couldn't deliver. In one case, something that was actually a forged divorce application. You discovered one guy was in a financial jam because he had a second wife who had expensive tastes, and you dummied up a divorce document, convinced him that you could get him out of this marriage he couldn't handle.
Yeah, false documents is something, you know, I learned to use in deception as a criminal interrogator. If you catch two young kids down here at the back of Walmart stealing TVs, I guarantee you the detectives are going to take them back to the station, put them in separate rooms, and use some form of deception. They might tell one that the other one is giving them information, or say the first person who cooperates is going to get a deal. But they're going to use deception. And deception is a legitimate part of warfare. You know, we don't question deception if infantry fakes an attack on the left and sweeps right. And interrogators can use deception too, but they must be careful about how they use that deception. And the reason why is because somebody else is going to interrogate that detainee one day. And if you've used deception and you've been found out, then they're going to have a harder time establishing trust. So what the senior interrogator has to do is they have to evaluate the gains versus the risk. What's the risk of losing rapport with this detainee by not following through on a promise versus the information you're going to get?
Now, when you would be with the detainee, and these were Sunni combatants that were brought in for your interrogations, and when they would say to you, you Americans caused this, you deposed the government, you disbanded the army, you allowed the Shia militias to terrorize our people, destroy our neighborhoods, remove our employment, how would you respond?
Well, my response is I agree with you that the United States has made mistakes in Iraq. I mean, nobody, at least in 2006, questioned the fact that some strategic errors were made in disbanding the army in the policy of de-Ba'athification, which put many Sunnis out of work who weren't really even supporters of Saddam. They just joined the Ba'ath Party to get a job. And so I would admit those mistakes. And almost every detainee that I admitted those mistakes to a T, they all were surprised that I was willing to admit that. And it moved many of them to hear that, because many of them had lost family members or friends because of these actions, because of allowing the Shia militias to run free. And so when they heard that apology followed by an offer to work together, it was very appealing to many of them. I talk about the first guy I interrogated in Iraq, Abu Ali, and the first thing he ever said to me was, if I had a knife right now, I'd cut your throat. And 3 or 4 days later, he was cooperating, providing us information. In fact, he provided the house where we captured the detainees that led us to Zarqawi. And that type of change happened because we were able to admit our mistakes and make the Sunnis an offer to work together in the future.
And what did you tell Abu Ali that turned him around?
I talked to Abu Ali, my partner, and I talked to him about his son. When we initially interrogated him, he didn't admit that he had a son. We found out later through another detainee that he had a son. And we painted for him a picture of what the future of Iraq would look like with the current violence just escalating into a civil war between Sunni and Shia. And instead, we painted a picture that it could look like, which would be a secure and safe Iraq if Americans and Sunnis could learn to work together.
You write in this book that the widespread belief in misguided stereotypes about Muslims and Arabs was the single most detrimental factor to effective interrogations in Iraq. What stereotypes are you referring to, and how did they undermine these interrogations?
Well, the stereotype I'm referring to are things such as a common parlance that was said by some interrogators and analysts, which is that Arabs grow up in a culture of violence, so they only understand violence. We have that documented in an email from a senior interrogator to his commander at one point in Iraq. And it was that type of stereotype of Arabs and of Muslims that was very counterproductive to trying to convince people to cooperate, because by not analyzing them and understanding them not as diehard jihadists who are, hate our way of life or want to reestablish a caliphate or believe in Sharia law, but instead as Sunni Iraqis who had individual motivations for joining al-Qaeda that were a broad variety of reasons from social, economic, and other reasons, we skipped the first step of every effective interrogation, which is to know your detainee. And so those prejudices worked directly in contrast to what we were trying to accomplish.
And you found that even among the al-Qaeda detainees that you spoke to, that by and large they were not driven by religious commitment but more by practical considerations of their lives?
That's correct. And Iraqi Sunnis are very secular. They're actually fairly moderate. In fact, they enjoy American movies and culture and TV and music. Iraqi Sunnis are actually very moderate people. They're very open to discussing religion and open to new ideas. I talked at length with several of my detainees about religion and religious philosophy, about Islam. And I found their interpretations of Islam to always be very reasonable. And so I think that by categorizing all the people that we interrogated at the very beginning as being a certain brand of Islam, the Wahhabi version or the Taliban version, was completely counterproductive to what we were trying to accomplish, which is to get to know them so we can understand how to work with them.
Now, some of the interrogators that you worked with, I believe, were veterans of Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib and came from a different, harsher set of techniques in interrogation. Were there differences and, you know, battles that played out among the interrogators over how to handle the detainees?
Yeah, there was a lot of battling at the prison when I was inside the prison between what I call the old school interrogators and my new school of interrogators. And those old school interrogators, the people who had been at Guantanamo Bay, been in Iraq and Afghanistan early on, who had been allowed to use enhanced interrogation techniques, which I believe is a euphemism for abuse, if not torture, believe that those methods should still be used. But now we had in place the Detainee Treatment Act. So what they started to do was to manipulate the rules so that they could still do what are basically enhanced interrogation techniques or use abuse. But try and notionally stay within the rules. And that created large differences between the ways that we wanted to interrogate certain detainees. For instance, we caught a guy named Abu Beda, who was a high-ranking member of al-Qaeda in the north of Iraq. And they immediately wanted to use a pride and ego down approach. And I had asked, why do we not consider using love of family approach?
And, now, when you say a pride and ego down approach, you mean what?
That would mean their idea was that they needed to insult him, to humiliate him, to bring down his ego, to bring down his self-respect and his self-worth, to put him lower than them so they could then force him to cooperate. And I suggested that we use love of family, which I had found to be the most effective approach against members of al-Qaeda. And lo and behold, later we found out that his son was being held in an Iraqi prison. We had him released and brought to our prison, and we put him face to face with his father. And as soon as Abu Beda saw his son, he broke down in tears. And he said to us, however I can help, I will. So it was love of family approach that ultimately got him to cooperate.
Mm-hmm. Did differences in results matter? I mean, did those of you who used newer, more flexible methods get more information? And was that, you know, noticed and observed by commanders and others?
It was when I showed up on the raid team to do interrogations out in the battlefield. They were very frustrated with interrogators that were there before us because they weren't producing as many results. And if I had to guess, it's always hard to put a number to the success of an interrogation because you don't know if you've gotten just a small piece of what a detainee knows, which may be very important, or if you've gotten 100% of what they know, all of which may not be important. But our success rate went up dramatically in the time that I was on the raid team working with my partner, who was a former street cop, using non-coercive techniques, law enforcement techniques, our knowledge of the culture. And I would say that by the end, by the time I left, our success rate was up probably around 80% where we'd get people to cooperate. And the commander came to me and actually said, you know, when you guys first got here, I had no trust in interrogators. And now I trust you more than any other form of intelligence.
I want to talk about your work in going out with soldiers in, I guess, search and capture missions. Is that what they were called?
Killer capture missions.
Killer capture missions. All right. So you would go out in this Stryker personnel carrier, and you'd find the house or apartment that was targeted, and the soldiers would then run in to sweep it, to gain entry and secure it, and then you would be summoned to go in and conduct an interrogation of people who would there be typically bound by their hands, right?
That's correct.
It's interesting that you use exactly the same description to describe the sound of the soldiers breaking in, right? The sound of an explosion, the sound of metal hitting concrete. What was going on?
You know, almost every raid started with the same noise, which is, you know, we would shuffle up to the fence or front gate or door, and the soldiers would go up to the front door and set a charge, some type of explosive that would blow the door off its hinges. Even to this day, when I hear metal falling onto stone, it jogs a memory of me of the front door going down on a house that's about to be raided. And then the soldiers would run into the house, and very swiftly and efficiently, and these guys were fast and professional, they would go in and they would capture people, and they would flex cuff them, you know, behind their back with flex cuffs, and then they would call us immediately to try and interrogate them as soon as we captured them. And my partner and I would come in, and we'd have to decide, you know, how many people are captured, who wants to interrogate the head of household, who wants to interrogate the wives, and then that's how we would start our approach.
Right. There would be two interrogators, you and your partner. Each of you would have an Iraqi translator. So then you would confront somebody who has been rousted from their bed or whatever, and they're there with flexicuffs on, and you would begin an interrogation. Now, how is that different in a field from talking to somebody in a prison cell?
Well, in the field, you only have 10 or 15 minutes to get information because the team doesn't want to stand out there in the open where they're at risk for ambush or attack. They want to get the information and move. And usually the objective is to go straight from that target to the next one to get information so that we can go do another killer capture mission before Al-Qaeda has a chance to react. So there's a much larger time pressure on the interrogators in battlefield interrogation scenarios. But it's much more fun, I think, because you have this dynamic of the ticking time, you know, counting down on you. But you also have a lot more moving parts. You know, for instance, the first mission I went on, we captured these twin brothers who were part of an Al-Qaeda cell. My partner and I immediately split the two up into separate rooms. And initially, we asked all the questions, and all their answers seemed to make sense. There weren't any discrepancies, but we knew that these guys had to know where the weapons dealer for the cell was, and they both claimed not to know who this person was. So we took a chance. We used an old cop technique where we went back in and told both brothers that the other one had told us where this weapons dealer lived, that it was two blocks over. And the guy I was interrogating said no, that I didn't know what I was talking about, but my partner's detainee said he was also wrong. The weapons dealer didn't live two blocks over. He lived four blocks over, and he took us to the house.
Hmm. When you have only a few minutes, can you establish the trust and rapport? Do you say nice things in Arabic? Do you refer to the Quran? Do you try and establish friendship?
Yeah, I try to do that. You know, one of the first things I always did was take my helmet off, put my hand on somebody's shoulder, assure them that I'm not going to harm their family, allow them to see their family, to see that they're not being harmed, and ensure them that they're not going to be mistreated. And that initial show of compassion towards them goes a long way because it's not what they're expecting at all. I mean, when you think about it, if you're going to be captured, your expectation is that right away you're going to get beaten. And I think a lot of Iraqis had that impression after the photos of Abu Ghraib were released, that they were going to be treated harshly upon their capture. And so the shell shock for them was when they were treated nicely. And that's what threw them off their game. That's what caused them to be quite confused. You know? And so we use that to our advantage. And we call that a fear down approach from the Army Field Manual. You try to lower somebody's fear, because not only does fear play against you because it causes people to shut up, to be careful about what they say, but it also affects memory. And as an interrogator, you want accurate and timely intelligence information. And as we like to say, if they tell you the location of a house, that's great, but it'd be better if they tell you if the house is booby-trapped.
How often did the team go to an address and then discover it was actually the wrong place, or the people were there that you were looking for, but it turned out you had bad information and they really weren't doing anything wrong and or didn't know anything?
I would say at least half the time when we went into a house, it ended up being the wrong house. And that's not to fault the Army. Counterinsurgency is complex, and it is difficult, and good, accurate intelligence information is difficult. I mean, and it's not like the houses have numbers on them, that there's even type of civil order that makes it easy, and the enemy's hiding within the civilian populace. It's extremely difficult to get good information that gets you directly to the right house. But what I say is that what's important is how you treat people in the wrong house. You can raid the wrong house, and you can leave with somebody having a better impression of us, even prior to us coming. And that might sound like it's quite impossible, but it's not. We raided a house three times. Brought an uncle back to the prison and then released him, brought a father of the guy we were looking for back to the prison and then released him, and later had that father help us capture our target, even though we had raided his house three times, because we had treated him with respect, we had paid him compensation, we had apologized for the inconvenience, restoring his respect and his honor.
You know, it's interesting because if half the time you went to the wrong place, you never knock on the door. You blow the door off its hinges. You go in. You roust people out. Soldiers empty contents of drawers onto the floor. I mean, you make a mess, and you damage property, and you humiliate them. You cuff them in front of their families. How do you make it right when you apologize?
Well, first of all, I mean, the Iraqis themselves, many of them were opposed to the violence that was being imposed by al-Qaeda, especially the suicide bombings, even if they didn't support the American occupation. They did oppose al-Qaeda violence. So many of them were quite understanding about why we were conducting the raids. They believed that we should be. They were disheartened that we came to their house, but they understood that our job was difficult. And they understood that if we treated them correctly, if we apologized, yeah, you might dump things out on the floor, but you might help pick them back up. You might leave them with cash that more than compensates them for the damage to their front door. But most important, the most important part of all of that is the apology. An earnest apology that says, hey, we made a mistake here. We're sorry, but we want to work with you. We're trying to make Iraq safer. And most Iraqis understood that.
And was it important to apologize to the men of the house in front of their families?
Very important, because this is a matter of respect and honor. You know, and this isn't some type of Arab cultural nuance. This would be the same way here in the United States. You know, we take pride in our houses and our ability to defend our homes. And when you come in there, you erode that pride and that self-respect for a head of household. So to apologize for them in front of their families restores that pride and that honor in their families' eyes and goes a long way.
You've written in the book and you've spoken about the harm that's done with enhanced interrogation techniques, you know, harsh techniques like waterboarding and stress positions and sleep deprivation, and torture, abuse, and that you believe that a lot more information comes when you get to know the detainee, you build trust and elicit information that way. There is, of course, those who argue strongly that the particular demands of the war on terror mitigate against that argument, that you need to get tough with people. You can't be nice to these committed terrorists. I mean, there were, of course, the CIA reports that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed broke down and cooperated after he was waterboarded. Do you put any stock in that story or those arguments?
Well, I won't be one to tell you that torture never works. I've had friends who have given me examples of when torture did work. But I don't care, because to me, this isn't about efficacy. We have other things that work 100% of the time, like chemical weapons and flamethrowers. We don't use them. And the reason we don't use them isn't an efficacy argument. It's because it's against our morality, or because the laws of war have determined that they cause unnecessary human suffering, and we've outlawed them. And there's no exceptions to that. I think my big disappointment is the shift in priorities from an America that stands for principles to an America that stands for security. My oath of office, when I took it as an officer in the United States military, didn't mention security. It mentioned allegiance and defending the Constitution, which prohibited torture when we ratified the Convention Against Torture and other provisions within the Constitution. So to me, I don't care if torture works 100% of the time. I'm not going to use it because it goes against the very principles that I signed up to defend.
And what's your sense of how interrogators in Iraq and Afghanistan today are approaching their jobs? Have things really changed?
I think it has changed. And my friends who are still in the field and still interrogating tell me that there is not torture and abuse going on, that it has stopped. But I recently, last year, had a senior Army interrogations instructor tell me that you still have to slap people around once in a while because that's all they understand. And I believe that you can't talk about torture unless you talk about the prejudice that led to the torture, that the two things are intertwined. And it was that prejudice against Arabs and Muslims and the stereotypes that were used against them that led to the torture. And so I think you can make rules that prohibit torture, but if you don't also make improvements to the way that we train and educate soldiers, that we'll still have incidents of torture and abuse. They might be much more rare, but the underlying conditions will still be there.
Well, Matthew Alexander, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Matthew Alexander was a senior military interrogator in Iraq. His new book is called Kill or Capture. Coming up, fascinating tales of brain function and dysfunction with neurobehaviorist V.S. Ramachandran. This is Fresh Air. Our next guest, V.M. Ramachandran, is known for thinking about the mysteries of the human brain in creative ways. In his new book, for example, he seeks to understand why a man in the hospital with a brain injury could speak to his father on the telephone, but was unable to recognize him or speak when his father entered the room. Ramachandran's research combines modern advances in neuroscience with low-tech, common-sense approaches, as you'll soon hear. His new book looks at unusual cases of brain dysfunction for clues about how the brain works. And he explores evolutionary explorations for the brain's complex wiring in what he calls a quest for what makes us human. V.M. Ramachandran is the director of the Center for Brain and Cognition and distinguished professor with the Psychology Department and Neurosciences Program at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Phantoms in the Brain. His new book is called The Telltale Brain. Well, V.S. Ramachandran, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's begin by talking about some of this amazing work you've done with mirror visual feedback. And this involves people who have had an amputation but who feel a phantom limb. Just first of all, explain that phenomenon. What happens to people when they're missing a limb and they feel these things?
Well, when an arm is amputated following a crush injury in a car accident, or there's a cancer or a malignant tumor or a cancer in the arm, or there's a gangrene, the arm is amputated, typically for diabetes. And then when that's done, 98% of the time, the patient continues to vividly feel the presence of that missing arm. And we call this a phantom limb. So typically the patient goes under general anesthesia and you've already told him that you're going to amputate his arm, unfortunately. And then you proceed with the amputation and he comes out of anesthesia. And he's surprised initially because under the sheets, he continues to feel the arm and he says, when are you going to do the surgery? Then you remove the sheets and show him that the arm is gone, and he's often shocked to see this because he continues to feel the presence of the arm even upon seeing that it's not there. This has been known for a couple of hundred years, but studied systematically over the last 100 years, and there have been dozens of case studies, but nobody really understood what was going on in the brain. Why would these people be haunted by these phantom appendages? You can get a phantom with almost any part of the body.
Yeah. And it was fascinating to read that some people will feel an itch in the palm of a hand that isn't there or feel chronic pain, right?
Yes. Chronic phantom pain is a serious clinical problem. About 2/3 of them, they have very severe pain, sometimes so excruciating that the patient becomes very depressed, sometimes often loses his job, sometimes even contemplates suicide.
Yeah. And before we talk about some of the work you did with mirrors to alleviate this, tell the story of the gentleman who you were able to discover regions of his face that would affect his sensory perceptions of his missing limb.
Well, there are nerves which used to supply the fingers and hand, which now supply the stump. But those nerves get irritated and misinform the brain that the hand is still there and surviving. and the nerves are painful, you get pain referred to the missing phantom hand. And based on this, the therapies were devised where you remove the nerves or the terminals of the nerves which are curled up and painful. This often provides partial relief, but is usually notoriously ineffective. What we did was a simple experiment based on an idea that there's a complete map of the body surface and the surface of the brain. So every point on the body surface has a corresponding point in the brain, and there's a systematic map. Now, the curious thing about this map is, even though it's continuous, all parts are represented, the face area of the map is right next to the hand area. It's dislocated instead of being near the neck where it should be, and nobody knows why. So our reasoning was, when the arm was amputated, the hand representation in the cortex is devoid of sensory input, is deprived of sensory input, becomes hungry for new sensory input. So the sensory input from the face skin sprouts terminals or invades the territory corresponding to the missing hand. So when you now touch the face, the hand area of the brain is activated, not just the face area. So the result of all this is very simple. You blindfold the patient so he doesn't know where you're touching him, and you touch his leg and his abdomen and his chest, and he accurately reports where you're touching him, obviously. But when you touch his face on the same side as the amputation, the patient says, oh, I feel that in my phantom missing thumb, and expresses considerable surprise.
Right. So this person might feel an itch in his palm, which he could scratch by touching the right spot on his face. And I guess one of the things this tells us is that the brain is growing new tissue, as even it doesn't just happen in embryo. I mean, new things are happening. The brain is sort of remapping itself a bit as we grow older.
Yes. I mean, what we were all taught as medical students, say a decade or two ago, was that connections in the fetal brain or an infant brain are fixed during infancy or fetal life by the genome, by genes. And then as you grow into adulthood, these maps crystallize and are there permanently. And you can't do anything to change these, alter these maps. And if there's injury to the brain, the injury is permanent. And there's very little recovery of function after tissue damage to the brain. Our findings suggest this is not true. The map, even the basic sensory map in the brain, gets completely reorganized in a matter of weeks. And more recently, we've shown that this happens in just a couple of days. You get some reorganization taking place. This challenges the dogma that all medical students are raised with and all neurologists are raised with, that no new connections or new pathways can emerge in the adult brain. That was news 10 or 15 years ago. Now it's widely accepted.
Okay, let's talk about this remarkable treatment that you developed for people who've had amputations and may have terrible pain in their phantom limb, and a treatment that you did with a simple mirror. Explain what you had your subject do.
Well, in simple terms, the patient has a phantom limb, and very often, for reasons that are not entirely clear, the phantom is clenched in an excruciating position, like the fingers are clenched into the fist, with the nails digging into the palm, the phantom nails digging into the phantom palm. And they'll often say things like, if I could only open my phantom hand or move my phantom arm, it might relieve this cramping sensation. But I can't do that. My phantom is paralyzed. I should backtrack a little bit and say that many patients with a phantom can move the phantom. They'll say, it's waving goodbye. It's patting my little brother on the shoulder. It's reaching out for the phone when the phone rings. These are very vivid sensory impressions for the patient. But in about a third to half the cases, the phantom is paralyzed, as I just said. It sounds like an oxymoron. How can a phantom be paralyzed? Well, we found when we looked at the case history, many of these people had a real paralysis of the arm, but the arm was intact. So, for example, nerves going from the spinal cord into the arm were yanked off the spinal cord in a motorcycle accident. So the entire arm is paralyzed and lying in a sling and excruciatingly painful and paralyzed for years. And then in a misguided attempt to get rid of the pain, sometimes the arm is amputated. And the irony is the patient is then left with a phantom arm and a phantom sling, and the pain persists with a vengeance in the phantom. And we call this phenomenon learned pain or learned paralysis. Question is, can you unlearn the learned pain or learned paralysis by allowing the brain to send a command to the phantom and have the phantom move in response to the command or appear to move? How do you do that? The guy doesn't have an arm, so how do you make his phantom appear to move?
You have to trick the brain in a way?
To trick the brain. How do you trick the brain? So then I hit on a technique of just using a $5 mirror, which you prop up on the table in front of you, put some bricks, or take a box, cardboard box, remove the top of the box, remove the front of the box, prop up a vertical mirror. And then the mirror is sort of parallel to your nose and sitting in front of you on the table. So or I should say, standing up in front of you on the table. Then the patient puts his phantom limb, let's say his phantom left arm, on the left side of the mirror, which is a non-reflecting side, puts the normal right arm on the right side of the mirror, which is a reflecting side, and looks into the mirror at the reflection of the normal hand. Now, if he then starts moving his two hands, of course he can't move his phantom, he can pretend it's moving, clapping his hand or conducting an orchestra or waving goodbye, while looking in the mirror, he's going to see the mirror reflection of the right hand superposed on the phantom, moving in command, moving in perfect synchrony with the command sent to the left hand, to the command sent to the phantom arm. So you get the visual illusion that the phantom, in fact, is obeying the command.
When you've done that, do patients say, oh, my God, I can actually see my phantom limb now?
Yes, absolutely. They get spooked out by it or they get intrigued. They'll say, my God, my phantom, I see my phantom. Of course, I know it's not there. Some people will look behind the mirror and chuckle. I know it's not there, but it feels like it's there. It not only looks like it's there, it feels like it's there. And when I move my normal hand, the phantom arm looks like it's moving. When I open the normal fist of the right hand, the phantom limb, whose fist I could not open for months, now suddenly feels like the fist is opening as a result of the visual feedback, and the painful cramp goes away. So this is a striking example of modulation of pain signals by vision.
You know, one of the fascinating things about the story that you just told is that modern medicine involves so many advances in sophisticated high-tech tests and treatments, and you're using a $5 mirror. And I have to note that you have a very, quite a varied intellectual background. You think of these problems differently, don't you?
Well, that is correct. I mean, I think that I was raised in India and I was raised in Thailand, where the emphasis was on low tech by necessity. And I think that emphasis actually is beneficial because it makes you think more creatively. Makes you more resourceful and rely on your ingenuity, so to speak. And this spills over into your research, this attitude and this technophobia. But I want to emphasize that often, we're not Luddites, we don't shun technology, but the initial experiments are often very simple, and the simplicity of the experiment is often deceptive and often, in spite of being simple, the results can be quite stunning. But more recently, we've studied an extraordinary syndrome where a patient says, we were just talking about phantom limbs earlier, but even more extraordinary and much more rare is a syndrome where a patient who's otherwise completely normal, in fact, you can't even call them patients, they're normal people out there, who want their arm amputated at a specific level.
Right. This is apotemnophilia, right? This is somebody who...
Apotemnophilia.
Okay. They think that a part of their own body is foreign to them, right?
Well, not exactly. Now, that's very interesting because in clinical medicine, it's very important to talk very carefully to the patient. And often, you can clinch the diagnosis 90% of the time, figure out what's going on by just talking to the guy, which is not fashionable these days. So, for example, this patient says, I want my arm removed. That's what he says. I want my arm removed. I know I'll be happier if it's removed. And he takes a felt pen and draws a line along which he wants the amputation, maybe just above the elbow, just below the elbow. It's different for different patients, or below the knee, right? And then he says, I want it amputated. And about a third of them go get it amputated.
Seriously? Do that?
Oh, absolutely. They'll go get it amputated, and they feel much happier. The depression goes away, and they feel like a more complete person, paradoxically. What they say is, it's not like the arm doesn't belong to me. I know it belongs to me. It's not like it feels like it doesn't belong to me. In fact, it feels like it belongs too much to me. It feels intrusive, right? Which is slightly different from saying it doesn't belong to me. Now, why the difference?
Yeah, what's going on?
Okay. You see, there are two stages. First of all, the signals from the arm, skin, muscles, tendons, and all of that go first to the sensory area in the brain, the vertical strip I told you about earlier when talking about phantom limbs. So there's a complete map of the skin surface and the muscles and all of that just on the side of the brain. That's where the sensory processing occurs. And then the signals are relayed on to the body image center, which then gets signals from vision and from your inner ear and all of that. So there's a more abstract representation of your body in the body image center, which is more dynamic. So there are two stages. The sensation is processed from the skin and ligaments and tendons and muscle. And then after that, it's sent to the superior parietal lobule where you construct a body image. Okay? So the sensory input going from the skin of the hand, from the muscles, from the tendons, goes to the sensory area and it's processed normally. That's not damaged because there's no stroke. But in his spina parietal lobule in the body image center, the arm is congenitally missing. So there's nothing, no place in the brain for the signals to be relayed to. And it gets there, and there is this acute discrepancy between his body image and what the sensory signals are telling him.
And what might cause that? Would that be a congenital defect? Or
it's a congenital defect, is what we think. Mm-hmm. And we've shown this using brain imaging techniques, that these people have a congenital defect in that region of the brain. You're still not 100% sure of this, but we're 90% sure that that's what's going on. And therefore, the signals come in from the arm. Sensory representation is normal, but there's nowhere for the signal to go. And the brain is faced with a discrepancy. And brain abhors discrepancy. It's constantly trying to produce a sort of coherencing of information to preserve stability of behavior. And when there's a discrepancy, the discrepancy is picked up by another region of the brain called the insula, which then generates the fight-flight response, generates acute anxiety. And the patient says, I want the arm removed. It feels overpresent. And it senses the discrepancy. So that's what's going on.
You write a lot about mirror neurons and the role that they played in our evolution. You want to just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, mirror neurons were not discovered by us, obviously, but they were discovered by Giacomo Rizzolatti in Parma in Italy and his colleagues. And what they refer to is in the front of the brain, in the motor and premotor cortex, there are neurons that issue commands to your hands and other parts of your body to perform specific actions, semi-skilled actions, skilled actions, or even non-skilled actions. So these are motor command neurons which orchestrate specific sequence of muscle twitches for you to reach out and grab a peanut, for example, or put it in your mouth. What Rizzolatti and his colleagues found was some of these neurons, as many as 20% or 30%, will fire not only when, let's say I'm measuring mirror neuron activity in your brain. So when you reach for a peanut, these neurons fire. But the astonishing thing is these neurons will also fire when you watch me reaching for a peanut. So these are promptly dubbed mirror neurons for obvious reasons. So it's as though your brain is performing a virtual reality simulation of what's going on in my brain, saying, hey, the same neuron is firing now when he's doing that as would fire when I reach out and grab a peanut. Therefore, that's what that guy is up to. He's about to reach out and grab a peanut. So it's a mind-reading neuron. It's essential for seeing other people as intentional beings who are about to perform certain specific intended actions.
And that might have helped us learn from one another and thereby advance culturally far beyond our...
That's correct. That's the step. That's kind of obvious by hindsight, but that's the claim I made about 10 years ago in a website run by Brockman called Edge. And what I pointed out was, and others have pointed this out too, is that mirror neurons obviously are required for imitation and emulation. So if I want to do something complicated that you're doing and I want to imitate it, I have to put myself in your shoes and view the world from your standpoint. And this is extremely important. It seems like something trivial, you know, mimicry, but it's not. It's extremely important because imitation is vital for certain types of learning, rudimentary types of learning. These days, you learn from books and other things, but in early days when hominids were evolving, we learned largely through imitation. There's a tremendous acceleration of the evolutionary process. What I'm saying is maybe there are some outliers in the population who are especially smart simply because of genetic variation, who stumbled, say, accidentally on an invention like fire or skinning a bear. Without the mirror neuron system being sophisticated, it would have died out, fizzled out immediately. But with a sophisticated mirror neuron system, your offsprings can learn that technique by imitation. So it spreads like wildfire horizontally across the population and vertically across generations. And that's the dawn of what we call culture and therefore of civilization.
Well, V.S. Ramachandran, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Enjoy that.
V.S. Ramachandran is director of the Center for Brain and Cognition at the University of California, San Diego. His new book is called The Telltale Brain. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Saman. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.